As Sean mentioned, my name is Jay Christian. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Geography at the University of Kentucky. I'm also a staff epidemiologist in the Department of Epidemiology, and I've been doing that for about 10 years. My talk today is based on my dissertation research, which I should mention was funded by the National Science Foundation through a doctoral dissertation research improvement grant. The title of the grant that was funded was Using Geospatial Technologies to Explore Activity-Based Food Environments. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the project as a whole to give you an overview, and then I'm going to focus in on this duration of GPS tracking sort of sub-study I did. Let me just get started here. First of all, I have no relationships to disclose. And this session is on measuring the food environment, and as most of you probably know, most research up to this point has focused in on the residential environment, the neighborhood in which people live. So it's really based on residential proximity or neighborhood density. Distance is often used to describe someone's, the spatial accessibility of food. Often we look at, people have looked at weight in relation to the distance to the nearest fast food restaurant or the nearest supermarket or that sort of thing. Density within the neighborhood of certain food stores or restaurants is also often used to describe the spatial accessibility of food. And this has, of course, been looked at in relation to BMI, socioeconomic status, and that sort of thing. I have several critiques of this. The first, of course, is there's no acknowledgement of individual mobility, really, in this research. You know, most people leave their neighborhood on a daily basis. The census estimates that the mean travel time to work for Americans is 25 minutes. So obviously people are getting out and about and likely have access to more food locations than are found within their neighborhood alone. I think this is pretty obvious to most people that when you look at where stores and restaurants are, they're often located at major intersections and in travel corridors. So this isn't anything, groundbreaking. Another critique is that these studies are often susceptible to the modifiable aerial unit problem. This is a particular kind of sort of ecologic bias where the results of your analysis can change based on the size and shape of the aerial units you're using in your analysis. Often there's also no measurement of diet and food purchasing. People often want to jump from food accessibility or what's in the food environment in relation to weight. And I think that we can all agree there's a couple links in this chain that are often sort of overlooked. So for my doctoral dissertation research, I wanted to develop a model of food accessibility based on activity space. Rather than residential proximity. Now, activity space is pretty well known to geographers. I don't know about you guys, but the idea of the activity space is it's the space where you conduct the business of daily living. It's where you work, where you take your kids to school, where you go shopping, this sort of thing. In addition, I wanted to collect diet and food purchasing data to look at some more links in that chain between accessibility and weight. And I wanted to use GPS technology to identify people's activity spaces rather than relying on travel diaries, which can be a lot of work both for the researcher and the research participants. It needed to be cheap, too, of course. Finally, I knew I would have to use GIS to look at the overlap between people's activity spaces and the food locations in the local environment. So my data sources were two questionnaires and the GPS tracking data. And I also got information on food locations from the local health department. They were coded using the NAICS as a guide into supermarkets, small groceries, convenience stores, limited service restaurants, and full service restaurants, as well as a couple other minor categories. So the basic research protocol, I mailed out flyers to every resident in a single census tract. That was over 1,400 flyers. Everybody got at least two flyers, and one low response area got another flyer. The flyer solicited telephone contact. Somebody would call in and say, "Well, you know, I'm interested. You know, tell me more about it." And I would tell them how things were going to work and make sure they were eligible. You know, I had some basic age eligibility requirements, and I also wanted to make sure that, you know, because I only had food locations for one county, I wanted to make sure that I was going to be tracking people when they weren't planning to leave town. So, so after we scheduled the first meeting, I consented them, and we did the first questionnaire, and I showed them how to use the GPS. Basically, that just means turning it on the next morning and leaving it on until the next time I saw them 3 days later. This is the GPS device I used. It has about a 40-hour battery life, and it has a vibration sensor. So if it sits still for 10 minutes, it shuts itself off and goes to sleep. And then when you pick it up, it comes back on again. So I managed to get 3 days of tracking for everybody, and nobody had to charge the GPS, which I think was a big plus. So there's the 3 days of GPS logging. When I saw them at the second meeting, I asked them a little bit about how it went with the GPS, if they had any problems. Most people didn't. And then I did a second questionnaire. I had to look at the GPS data to make sure there were no big gaps or holes. And if there were, sometimes I could correct those by calling the participant and asking them, you know, where were you from this time to this time on this day? And I could go in the GIS and fill in that gap if I needed to. And then the analysis. So this is an example of an activity space. This is actually from my pilot study that a coworker helped me out with. So this person carried the GPS data logger for 3 days, and the green area you see is their activity space, what we call a daily path area. And this is just a quarter mile buffer around their GPS track. So you can also see there's some food locations in the big orange dots are supermarkets. The black dots are full-service restaurants, and the white dots are limited-service restaurants. So everything that's within the green area would be counted as part of this person's unique food environment. This is another example. This is a half-mile buffer around this person's activity or GPS track, and I ended up using a half-mile buffer because I got many more significant results using the half-mile than the quarter-mile. So there's a little trial and error there. You can see here, this is Census Tract 5, which was the one census tract where all the participants came from. So, in the analysis, the first thing I had to do was create my activity-based food environment measures. So, the first was, you know, I calculated the density of all those different food and restaurant types within the daily path area. And then I also calculated some proportions, you know, the proportion of restaurants that were limited service out of all of those within the activity space, the proportion of food stores that were supermarkets out of all of the food stores that were in their activity space. And then lastly, I did this retail food environment index. I don't know if anybody's familiar with this, but this is essentially the ratio of convenience stores plus fast food restaurants divided by supermarkets and fruit and vegetable markets. Now, you'll notice, of course, there's a lot of stores and restaurants, not really restaurants, but there's stores left out of this calculation, small groceries, specialty stores. Some of those places I just sort of considered neutral with regard to healthfulness. You know, small groceries do have maybe a limited selection of fruits and vegetables, but not as much as a supermarket, but they also have a lot of packaged processed foods, and it's kind of a wash, I feel like. So I wanted to look at these measures in association with diet, food purchasing, and weight status, in addition to comparing them to what was in the neighborhood itself using these same sort of methods. So basically the findings of the main study were that the activity-based food environment measures were very different than the neighborhood. You know, people encountered a much larger number of food stores and restaurants in their activity space than their neighborhood. No big surprise there. These activity-based measures also varied significantly by age, income, education, and marital status. So there is some variation there. The RFEI was the most promising measure. And I did see some significant associations with obesity status, as well as whole grain intake, and fruit, non-potato fruit and vegetable intake was also very nearly significant. There wasn't as much that was, the density measures didn't produce sort of intuitive results. The density measures, the density of the food in locations is going to be very closely related to the density of urban development generally. So I think that's one reason those didn't turn out to be very significant. Okay. So there's been some other research that's similar to this. Keston's in Quebec, Zenk in Detroit, and then my own. And you'll notice we all use different sort of durations. You know, Keston's 1 day travel survey, Zenk 7 days of GPS tracking, myself 3. So I thought, is 3 weekdays really enough? Everybody did 3 days, and towards the end I had a little money left over, so I thought I'd recruit some people to do 7 days so I could then compare. So I had about 20 people who I invited to do this. Unfortunately, I only ended up with about 13 comparisons, but because it's matched, I do have a little more power in the statistics. I'm going to go over some of these really quick since I'm running low on time already. Basically, I just wanted to show this slide. The bold shows the significant differences between the 3 day and the 7 day measures. And you'll notice that supermarket density was no different when you compare 3 days and 7 days. And the RFEI was no different. And that was one of my most powerful sort of predictors in my models. So I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. There were also a lot of correlations between the 3 and 7 days. So even with 3 days, I felt like I was sort of on the right track. You know, there wasn't much that was wildly different. Okay, these are some maps showing both. The 7 day daily path areas are in pink, and the 3 day are in blue. And where they overlap, you'll see it's purple. So you see a lot of overlap. Often the 3 day was entirely within the 7 day. Sometimes they were very different. But really, like I said, the RFEI was often very similar. So, in conclusion, the duration of GPS tracking, could be important for things like density especially. That was different for a lot of the measures, but not really for RFEI. So it depends on really what you want to look at. I certainly think that fewer days is less difficult. If you spend 3 days with the GPS tracking, it really gives you more time to recruit more people. 7 days of evaluating 7 days of GPS tracking data takes at least twice as long as evaluating 3 days for gaps and that sort of thing. And it was more difficult. With the longer duration, there's just more chances that the GPS is going to lose reception or something like that. It really kind of boils down to what you're really interested in. If you're interested in looking at somebody's everyday activity space, the places where they are almost every day, or if you're more interested in maybe their overall mobility, then, maybe 7 days is the way to go. And this could be different for different restaurant or food types. Daily activity space might be better for fast food restaurants because that's sort of, We eat what's convenient sometimes, right, in the course of our daily lives. But things like supermarkets, people sort of plan more for you. So if the supermarket you like is on the other side of town, you might just go there once or twice a month or whatever. I really can't wait to do this in more contexts. Lexington is a moderate-sized city at best, but I think there's a lot of potential here to compare rural, suburban, urban areas. I think there would be some very different activity spaces. Okay, I think I just made it in in time. Any questions or comments? Not very many. She asked how many people who responded were low income. The census tract where I did the research, between 2000 and 2010, it changed quite a bit. So when I was planning this, I had hoped to get more. But like I said, the socioeconomics of the neighborhood changed. It's near downtown the university, so there were more grad students and faculty sort of moving into the area. You know, I wasn't too concerned because I was really more interested in getting good data to play around with the methods and the techniques. There were a handful. Everything was skewed towards the middle, really, as far as socioeconomics. He asked if I would consider using smartphones in the future. The GPS data loggers I use are $100 a piece. They're not too expensive, and I'd say they probably do give you better data. I haven't figured out quite the best way to use smartphones. I don't know if contacting the carrier would be the best way to go, or I've been thinking that I need a partner who does programming so they could create an app for me, right? That, you know, somebody could just start the app and it would go, and maybe prompt them at mealtimes to, you know, what are you eating right now and where? So if anybody knows how to program for the iPhone or Android, come talk to me. The dietary data, self-reported from, it was the NHANES dietary screener. It's a 26-item, sort of abbreviated food frequency questionnaire.
I have a question, actually.
Sure.
I think that's really interesting work, and I think an important advance in the way we're thinking about this. So I have two questions. One is, you know, a lot of my patients tell me that they take these bulk shopping trips once a month, right? They go to some discount warehouse and they just stock up. Would it be cost prohibitive to do this on a month basis? I mean, so 3 days to 7 days. Would it be possible even in a small family to do it on a month, or is that just logistically impossible? And then the second question is, do you know anything about the validity of the food environment data that you use from the health department? Like how well that represents what's actually on the ground?
Yeah, actually there was I looked recently at the USDA data that's at the county level that you can get from their website, and it was actually very similar to what we had from our health department. I'm very confident in the accuracy of my data because I had somebody comb through it, and I'm local. I've lived in Lexington most of my life, so I have a pretty good handle on the area just from my own personal knowledge. As far as tracking for like up to a month, I think that is possible. It might be better with like the smartphone idea because it's something somebody already has on them. You know, I only had to buy 20 of these data loggers. I didn't even use them all because I could just cycle them around, and you wouldn't be able to do that as much, you know, with, you know, that duration of tracking. You'd probably have to invest a little more in equipment, you know, unless you had a very small sample size. And I guess even with a small sample size, I think there's a lot that would be interesting in the data. Thanks.